was sent an email by a good, good friend back home that I ride motorcycle with. He's worked in ag all his life. You know, Doug is, he saw this project and he just, you know, he knew that this was going to play out in the news. Well, we're going to bring Wade Basons in on this conversation. Wade is, he is the executive director of Summit Carbon Solutions. Now, most recently, he was the president and general manager of BNI Energy. He served on the North Dakota Empower Commission since 2014. In 2018, Wade was named chairman of the Lignite Energy Council. The reason I put all that out there is so you know what a broad, diverse skill set that he brings into this conversation. Wade, good to have you here with us on News and Views.
Well, thank you. Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, okay, the project. Summit Carbon Solutions partners with Blue Ammonia Project to decarbonize ag supply chain. That's a lot. For the average person out there driving in their pickup or their car right now, describe what this project is.
Yeah, so the Summit Carbon Solutions project is really proposing to capture CO2 from ethanol plants in industrial facilities across the five-state area, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska. Aggregate that CO2 into a pipeline system, all new construction, and deliver it to Western North Dakota, Oliver and Mercer counties for injection and permanent storage. Most recently announced was our letter of intent working with the Great Plains Nitrogen Plant proposed up by Grand Forks to capture the CO2 from that fertilizer production, transport it into that system, and inject it and permanently store it in Western North Dakota, the Williston Basin geology. So in essence, what that's doing is it's really marrying energy, agriculture, and carbon management together right here in North Dakota, where you're taking natural gas produced in the Bakken, converting it to fertilizer that can be used by our farmers to grow corn that is feeding the ethanol, and take the carbon from all of that supply chain or that production process and permanently sequester it and store it here in North Dakota, therefore lowering the carbon intensity of that pathway of that energy and those ag supplies, and then maximizing the value of those products in the low carbon markets that now, you know, we find ourselves in a position where you know, markets are demanding and assigning a premium to lower carbon food and fuel products. And so that really uniquely positions North Dakota with the, you know, with this project in that way.
So another product that can come out of ethanol that can put a profit, you develop it into something that farmers so desperately need in the area of a cheaper fertilizer. Yeah. It's just the logistics that we got to talk about is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's do that. When this first concept started getting floated out there, we had the governor on to speak to the concept itself. And of course, he was, you know, very upbeat about what this could do. I started getting pushback, Wade, from individuals saying, how are they going to pipe it? How is the pipeline going to work? How are they going to be crossing our land? I mean, there was some drawings out there of how this could happen. Where are we at with that, moving the product itself?
Sure. So we have, you know, did the desktop routing of the pipeline facilities across the footprint. So really to interconnect all of the sources of CO2 to a main line and ultimately deliver them to Western North Dakota. So we've identified a route. We've surveyed the majority of that route now, baseline cultural, environmental, archaeological survey. And now we're at the phase of going out and meeting with the landowners, requesting a easement from them, and really educating them on the property, working with them, or on the project, excuse me, working with them on the alignment and the routing of that project across their property, and seeking voluntary easements from the landowners to site the pipeline across their properties.
I did this, maybe not to this scale, but actually when you add up the miles, I think I could match up. But when I first started at Real Water, there was a little over 500 miles of water line out there, which means you had to have easements, you had to work with the townships, you had to work with the counties, you had to do, you know, the school districts in some cases, all of that. And then when I left their employment, we had 2,800 miles. So I know what it's like to go out there and cross a farmer's land. Mm-hmm. The difference between then and now, you know, if I went back to doing that kind of work, is farmers have tiled the heck out of their land. Mm-hmm. You know, it isn't like I can just cut across here mm-hmm. and worry about where the power, where the telephone is anymore. It's way deeper than that in terms of the amount of work that has to be done. Was that figured into the routing at all, Wade?
Yeah, it was. And that's really a big part of the negotiation of and working with the landowners on the location of the pipeline across their property. A big component of that is working with them to better understand where exactly are the drain tiles, or do they have plans for future drain tiles? And so then we can now at this stage design our system so that the two can coexist together. So we can do, there's lots of things we can do on the front end to make modifications to the drain tile system that's there, or plan for it in the future, change the depth of our line so that it doesn't interfere with the operation of the drain tile system later, or make modifications to the system before you put the pipeline in so that you put in headers and do different things to make that a functional drain tile system before and after.
How big a diameter of the pipe are we talking about? Obviously, it's going to vary.
Yeah, it varies. So in this area, there are 4- and 6-inch lines. We have a 4-inch line coming from Fergus Falls across and then tying into a 6-inch line coming down from Castleton. And when those two intersect, then it's 8-inch line and where it ties into a 24-inch main line that's coming through South Dakota and up to western North Dakota to the storage facility area.
Is my home area, is Hankinson part of this?
Yes.
Oh, they are. Okay.
So the Hankinson plant today is not part of the project. The Tharaldson plant is, the nitrogen plant proposed to be part of the project as well. Obviously the Hankinson plant is very close to the vicinity of the project. And so we're, optimistic continuing to work them to have them become part of the project.
So you're looking to partner with them if you can make it all work financially.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. So you're, did you say Oliver and Mercer? Where are you taking this to?
Yeah, to Oliver and Mercer County, North Dakota.
So just rudimentary. You're in a science class room with fifth graders. Yep. Describe how this works.
So in essence, what we are doing is injecting CO2 at pressure, so it's liquid CO2, into a porous rock formation. So within the Williston Basin geology, we have multiple layers of sands and sandstones that have high permeability, high porosity, so high capacity to store additional fluids, that are surrounded by impermeable rocks that seal it. And that's what creates the container for storage. You have hundreds to thousands of feet of impermeable rock and then hundreds of feet of porous rocks. And you're storing the CO2 into those porous rocks.
Okay. So there's no danger here of taking on, you can pollute the ground, you can pollute the groundwater, anything like that.
Yeah, so the entire regulatory process is designed around protecting the freshwater zone.
Okay.
And the groundwaters, the U.S. drinking water sources. That's the entire regulatory structure and the process of developing and designing and developing and ultimately monitoring these facilities is designed around the protection of groundwaters.
So you're taking a product that normally would be injected into the atmosphere. Right?
That's right.
At these plants. You're harnessing it. You're putting it in a pipeline. You're heading it off to Oliver and Mercer County. You're going to store it in the soil. And then what?
Yeah. So then it will be ejected into the formations and will be permanently stored in that way, monitored from below the surface and above the surface to verify that it's staying where we put it and monitor how it spreads within the property so we know where it's at. Okay. And so that's how it's permanently contained and verified to be permanently contained.
Okay. Then the obvious question is, how much room is there?
So there's a number of third-party studies out there on the capacity to store in the Williston Basin, and they range between 150 and 250 billion tons of CO2. So to put that in context, that's enough capacity to store all the CO2 currently emitted in North Dakota for more than 8,000 years. It's a huge resource.
So when it's all done, say you take a quarter of land just to put it in the landscape that I can understand. Say you take this quarter of land and you store CO2 in it. Does that take away what I can do with the land? Have you devalued the land?
No, I don't believe we've devalued the land in any way. What we're doing is providing landowners, so the pore space is owned by the surface owner. So we're creating an opportunity for the surface owner now to monetize the value of their subsurface that didn't previously exist. So you think about the space that we're occupying with the CO2, it's 1 to 2 miles below the surface. But farming and ranching and agriculture on the surface can continue in the future just as it has in the past.
You're going to shake your head and say, why is he asking me this one? But because doesn't he get the concept of the science of it? But I think people are going to think this. You said surface owner. This doesn't involve the mineral rights owner at all.
It does not. It does not restrict the mineral rights.
So the fights that went on as the Williston Basin was developed between the surface owners and the mineral rights owners, that won't be part of this?
I don't believe so.
No. Does the oil industry like this?
The oil industry has been supportive, very supportive of carbon capture and storage. They need to address their carbon footprint as well.
Wade, hang with me. Yep. All right. This is fascinating, quite frankly. Wade Basons is our guest. He is the executive vice president of Summit Carbon Solutions. We were talking about the project that they've put in place to inject carbon into the soil up in Oliver Mercer counties. And Wade, I always, you know, the project interests me enough, so we're talking about it on the break, and then I'm like, all right, don't forget to ask them that when we are on air. Let me give you an example. Is this happening anywhere else in the United States or Canada?
Yeah, today they're capturing CO2 from an ethanol plant near Decatur, Illinois, been injecting and storing the CO2 from an ethanol plant for about 5 years.
Okay. When you do this, when you get started, how long after you begin your project before it's ended? And let me add one more to it. You know, will the federal government be part of this? How are you paying for it?
Yeah, so the project itself, it's about a $4.5 billion capital investment to construct the entire system, capture pipelines, storage facility, all that infrastructure, about $4.5 billion, all private and debt financed. So no government money to build the project.
Okay.
However, a portion of the revenue for the project is based on the federal tax credit, $50 per ton of CO2 that's stored and verified to be permanently stored, similar to a wind production tax credit.
Because the federal government wants CO2 captured and stored.
Correct.
Right?
Yep. So they're incentivizing that activity to permanently sequester.
Exactly. So thus giving you the incentive.
Yep.
So who owns it all when it's done?
So the project is being developed by Summit Ag. The company is Summit Carbon Solutions. The investors of the project own it when it's done.
This is okay. When I look at this project from the outside looking in, I look at this big industrial project that helps. I'm just going to give you the rosy picture from my standpoint.
Sure.
I want ethanol to succeed.
Yep.
Okay. You're grabbing carbon from ethanol. You're taking it to a place where you can store it, thus helping ethanol, just turning something else into something else you can make money on. Just the construction alone, obviously, there's going to be a financial benefit to all of that. To me, in an ag base where you're dealing with fertilizer and some other things, other than crossing farmers' land and getting the easement to do that, where's the negative?
There really isn't one. You know, the farmers, I think, that we're crossing understand the value proposition, right? This makes the corn markets more sustainable, the ethanol industry more sustainable, and us more competitive in the markets, both our ag and energy sectors. So that's not the issue. They get the value proposition of the project. It really comes down to the location of the line. You know, farmers generally are not, landlords are not excited to have additional infrastructure on their property.
Yeah. Tell me.
Yeah. And so that's really it, is those kind of two things, is getting comfortable that, hey, it can work with their drain tile systems. It's not going to interfere with that. Not going to interfere with their operations on the surface. And so really it's those aspects that, farmers are most concerned about.
I have absolutely no doubt you and I are going to have more conversations about this, and ones where, as farmers find out more, you know, they all as a group want to get access to you. It's my understanding you've been going out to meet with farmers in a collective small group type basis as well, if they want to. Congratulations for that, because that's the way to get it done.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on, Wade.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.